A big show Monday, June 10th, we talked to a public relations expert who shared his thoughts on elevating political discourse in the U.S. A Quinnipiac professor stopped by to give his thoughts on the merger between United Technologies Corporation and Raytheon. And finally, we talked to an author whose new book details a little-known outbreak of bubonic plague that almost wiped out San Francisco.
About here, we've already tackled this once or twice, so we'll do it again. Why not? The fact that you, meaning me, we just, there's some people you can't discuss current affairs or politics with before you are told that you are some sort of, you know, piece of filth. You are spawned from some sort of ugly creature. I thought I knew you. How could you be for him or her, this and the other? And the level of discourse, especially in some families, is not good. Well, joining us right now is a seasoned public relations executive. His book out, it's fascinating. It's called I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. Now, I've never called people idiots. Misinformed? Well, something like that. Jim Hogan is the guest. Jim, Paul in Bridgeport, how are you?
Hi, Paul. I'm good.
Well, We have a scenario here where, and you wrote this book a couple of years ago, but you're probably selling more copies now than you ever had. We are seeing this, Jim, this finger pointing, this teeth gnashing, the fist clenching, I don't know how else to put it, of people trying to discuss politics and current events. It doesn't, at least in my sphere, doesn't show any sign of slowing down.
No, I started in the public relations business years and years ago, back when facts actually mattered, and in our business we were essentially helping clients to be better understood, mm-hmm. right? So we would help them with messages and help them be clear and help them with all the things that common sense says you should do in order to get your message out. But the trend over the last 20 years or so has become more and more tribal, and it's almost like rather than convincing people of something, you basically try to get them thinking that this isn't something that people like us believe, and if you do believe this, you can't be one of us, you must be one of them. And one of the guys I interviewed for my book is a guy named Jonathan Haidt, and he said he studies the psychology of teams.
Mm-hmm.
And he says when you divide into teams, open-minded, and that psychology takes over, open-minded thinking just shuts down. And so you start to see this growth of unyielding one-sidedness. And the weird thing about it is the more time I spent interviewing people, and I interviewed about 70 thought leaders and academics from around the world on this, and the more I learned about it, the more shocking it was, because it doesn't matter whether you're on the right side of the issue, whether you're correct on the facts and the other person is wrong, you can be just as much of a problem as far as polluting public discourse as, you know, like what's the worst thing on trying to deal with difficult issues? Denial that they exist, mm-hmm. or self-righteousness?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, both of those things have kind of unreasonableness kind of inside them.
And, you know, a lot of this, James, and I've talked about this with other folks, we don't take into account, I think, the upbringing of some people and what their life situations may have dealt them previously. In other words, we can take for example, the abortion debate that's going on now. And to me, it's very difficult, I've always thought, to try and argue, say, an issue like abortion when you may have never had to make that decision in your life, or nobody close to you has, versus somebody who for some reason had to make that decision, or had a mother or a daughter or someone who was touched by that decision. So I've always thought, Jim, that that's, you know, that's a barrier right away.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's funny. It's how hard it is for us when we feel strongly about something to respect someone who disagrees with us. But it's an important thing that we need to do if we want a healthy democracy. I mean, the fact is that, you know, good people do bad things for good reasons all the time. And, you know, just because somebody disagrees with you doesn't make them evil. You know, it's quite possible they may be a good person who's just somehow got it wrong. And so, you know, one of the people I interviewed for my book was the Dalai Lama. And right at the end of the interview with him, he pointed at my forehead and he said, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but in Tibet, we go with the heart, and that may be stronger. You know, maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart and we bring them together, we can have more success with these conflicts.
See, you know, Jim, I and a guest, by the way, is James Hogan. Name of the book is I'm Right and You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Political Discourse and How to Clean It Up. I always say it doesn't matter what side of the political aisle you're on here, Jim, I've always said I wonder openly about the sanity of some people who can tell me I've never changed my position on one issue at all. I mean, that's just not, maybe it's true, but to me, Jim, that just doesn't make any sense as far as the human condition is.
It's not a very good basis of good human relations. I mean, we all should be keeping in mind that we could be wrong. You know, that it's not just other people who could be under the influence of bias. We ourselves could. And I think if you approach it that way, it's important for people to feel strongly about things, but
sure.
The reason that you also can't be respectful.
Absolutely. And no, respect, and you have to, and what I try to do in this business of being on the radio every day, James, is I try to take a breath before I say something. In fact, that's why you'll have gaps on my show of 4 or 5 seconds when I don't say anything, because I'm actually trying to make sure, you know, that mouth and head are coordinated here. And we can both probably in our lives and in our lines of work, you probably are counseling some people as far as PR is concerned. You can probably tell them, you know, look, and here's 5 instances where you shouldn't have said what you said.
Right. You know, Peter Senge was one of the fellows I interviewed for my book, and he said, surprising as it is, most people aren't sitting around waiting for you to tell them what to think. You know, most people don't like being told what to think.
Mm-hmm.
And so with that in mind, this idea of kind of shoveling information, you know, whether you're a climate scientist or an advocate of some sort trying to force your information on people is just flawed, because that's not how people work. That, you know, most people are not just waiting around to admit they were wrong.
James, you know what I think pollutes things? Toxic is right, too, in your title there. And for example, I have 2 good friends of mine who I've known for years and years and years, and 2 very, very, I mean, off-the-wall smart people. We're not talking dummies here. One of them, a guy that I've worked with for years and years, he is wanting to say there's no reason anybody other than the police or the government should own a gun. Okay. I also know a woman, again, whip smart, James, who says, listen, no man should ever have any voice in anything to do about any policy connected to abortion. Okay. That, yeah, you see, those to me, even though I can readily admit that I did not feel what they felt growing up, it's phrases like that that aren't helpful. You know what I mean?
Yeah, one of the people I spoke to for my book was this woman named Carol Tavris, and she used to be the editor of Psychology Today. She's a psychologist, and she wrote a book called Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. And she,
I love that.
Yes, it's a fantastic book, and she said that as soon as people make a decision on something, they take a position on something. they start to look for all the reasons that they were right about the decision. So it could be about anything.
Yeah.
And the more time, public face, and money, and effort you put into this decision or this position that you have, the less likely you are to be even able
mm-hmm.
to admit you're wrong. She said there's like a process of self-justification that prevents us from recognizing that we may have done something stupid or immoral because we see ourselves as good, smart people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want to think of ourselves that way, so we tend to dig in. And so we have to be extremely careful in communicating with people like that if you want to change their mind.
Yeah.
And I think we need to get better at not just, you know, cutting our ideas or our principles in half, but at creating common ground with people who we see as the enemy or someone who strongly disagrees with us, so that you... Because most, you know, 80% of stuff we agree on.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
We don't want to start there.
Yeah, and you know, it is, you know, and I have another friend who I work with at another job, at a side job, and again, whip smart guy, very smart, but he took the absolute tack with me. We were talking one day about gun rights. He goes, I got to tell you something. He goes, I live in the greater New York area. He goes, it's very hard for me to have a gun. I really wouldn't want one. He said, but, about a month ago, I went down and visited one of my old college roommates, he said, and he's from Alabama. And he put me up. His parents were wonderful. We had great times together. And he goes, you know what? We went to a gun range. And he goes, I shot everything from a pistol to an AR-15. He said, I'm not going to go out and buy one. He goes, but I understand, James. He said, I understand the culture. I understand where my friends, family, and relatives come from on this, and that's fine. I have no, you know, no sort of ill will toward him on this.
Well, good for him, eh?
Yeah, I mean, he really, and this is the guy, he goes, no, I get it. He goes, I get it. We are who we are because of where we live and our upbringing. I wish more people, James, could be like that.
I think we have to start assuming that people aren't idiots, that they're not evil, just because they don't agree with us.
Yeah.
We have to assume the opposite. And most of the time, I think you'd be right.
You know, James, you're in the PR business, and now we are in an era, James, that far different, I think, from when you and I grew up, where a company can just innocently do something wrong with an ad or say something wrong at a corporate event or you know, sign up with the wrong spokesperson, and you have an army of people who just want to ruin the company, put them out of business, make everybody who works there a pauper. I mean, that's another thing, too, that's just, you know, driving me crazy. I mean, look, we do have the power of the purse, James, I understand it, but now it's just everybody's on a little too much of a hair trigger.
Yeah, I agree. I really agree, and it's, you know, it's good for my business, but it is, you know, social media has made it a lot worse and a lot quicker.
Yeah. I mean, if you're working for a fast food company and they try our new crunchy flying Mexican burrito. Oh, there you go, you're hitting on Mexicans. No, what are you talking about? But like you say, you must make some pretty good dollar off of that, telling people how to respond.
Well, you know, back in the early times, I remember that a lot of our work, you know, whether it was for, you know, pulp mills or steel mills or whatever, was explaining the company.
Yeah.
So if there was a problem with a certain kind of, you know, with, say, dioxins and furans, you know, causing
right.
cancer,
yeah.
that you were basically trying to have a conversation with the community, explaining, consulting, getting out there and communicating. But the way things are today with social media, a lot of the advice is just duck. You know, it's getting out there, and because when you live in a world where facts don't matter as much, it's really hard to explain yourself. And if the assumption is that just because you're a corporate guy that you can't be trusted.
Yeah, exactly.
And which isn't true. You know, I could count on one hand the number of clients I've had over the years that I don't particularly trust. But and I've had a lot of clients. So most people in business are just ordinary guys.
Yeah, and they have to meet a payroll, and they're paying people who have families. You know, this is not some evil witch's cabal that they're representing or that you're representing.
Yep, absolutely. But the fact is that when public discourse is as polluted as it is right now, there's this kind of, it's not just that facts don't matter, it's that, you know, the assumption is that everybody's biased. Mm-hmm. You can't trust anything that anyone says. Everybody's just saying what they have to say for their own interests. No one is really out there kind of just telling the truth or shooting from the hip. And so in that kind of an atmosphere, it's really hard to be understood. It's really hard to make your point. And that is not good. It's not healthy. I mean, we need
yep.
spaces for healthy discourse where we can disagree passionately,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, not resort to name-calling and demonizing somebody who's on the other side of the argument.
And as my 90-year-old Italian aunt always says, James, she steps back. You know what she does? She steps back, she takes a deep breath, and she counts to 10.
Good for her.
Oh, yeah. I'll see her in the kitchen. I hear her going, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. That's where it's time for us to get out of the kitchen. Name of the book is I'm Right, You're an Idiot, The Toxic State of Public Discourse and How to Clean It Up. It's in paperback right now. And PR consultant James Hogan has been the guest. James, thank you. I've had some fun. I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Have a good
bye-bye.
Day.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye. There you go. I actually do have a true story. My 90-year-old aunt, yep, 80-something, 90. Yeah, that was one of her mantras. Turn around. I hear the breath going. I hear it go 1, 2, 3, 4. I said, you know, okay, clear out the kitchen because some steam is going to be blowing off here. Big news, although it was not completely unexpected. United Technologies Corporation announcing a merger with Raytheon. The company is going to be known as Raytheon Technologies. They are moving the longtime Connecticut headquarters of UTC from Farmington up to the greater Boston area. That's where the headquarters of GE moved from Fairfield a couple of years ago. So, you know, at first glance, this is only, as they say, only 100 executive jobs. But, you know, a lot of folks are going, uh-oh, about this. And joining us right now to lend his perspective on it, a guy who should know, Professor Fred McKinney. He's the Carlton Highsmith Chair of Entrepreneurship and Strategy and Director of the People's United Center for Entrepreneurship and Strategy at Quinnipiac University. Professor McKinney, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I'm here. I just heard a loud noise.
No, that was that was me, Professor, with my fat fingers on the wrong button. So that's
okay.
That's Professor. Thanks for joining us. First of all, what's your what was your initial thought when you heard this news? Were you surprised or not, or somewhere in the middle?
My first reaction was wow.
Really?
I'm somewhat familiar with both companies because both companies were members of an organization that I used to run, the Greater New England Minority Supplier Development Council. So I worked very closely with both organizations. And, you know, they are fantastic companies in terms of their corporate support for a lot of activities around the region. Secondly, as I thought about it, you know, there are a lot of changes taking place in corporate America these days. And so this is, like you said, it's not completely a surprise. I would not have predicted it, though. But it's not a surprise after the fact that these two large companies and defense contractors are getting together. As you know, UTC has been very active in recent years with its selling of the Sikorsky division to Lockheed Martin,
yep.
and then you know, its purchase of the company Collins. So they've been active, and so I guess you can kind of look at this as part of sort of this reorganization, because in addition to the quote merger between UTC and Raytheon, it's also announced as part of this that UTC was going to spin off its non-defense, non-aerospace businesses, Carrier and Otis. And I understand that those two companies are going to be two separate standalone companies that'll be traded on the market as individual separate companies. So a lot of activity.
Professor, how long do you think, I mean, we always hear about it when it happens, but how long do you think discussions of a decision of this magnitude went on? A couple of years, you think? I mean, this doesn't happen overnight in a vacuum here.
Well, sometimes it does. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, all of these deals are different and unique in their own ways, and it usually happens as kind of a relationship between senior leaders or a relationship between senior leaders, advisors, and each other. And so, you know, there might be advisors, and I don't know who the banks are, the investment banks who are involved in this, but usually investment banks and investment lawyers are involved, and somebody may have, you know, said, you know, this might be worth looking into. And after some preliminary discussions, things do move very quickly because word does get out. And so they have to decide whether to move forward or cut it off and move on. And so once these things start to happen, they happen really quickly.
So it could have just been a couple of meetings, maybe a chance telephone call, or like you say, some of the financial folks said, hey, let's run this up the flagpole and see what their response is to it.
That's correct. And, you know, somebody's doing some analysis that, you know, pitched the idea to one of the companies first, and then, you know, there are all kinds of relationships in large corporations. They may share a director, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't surprise me. Or they may have, attorneys that know each other, either with the same firm or of other firms. So, you know, this is a relationship business, even at the billion-dollar merger stage. These are still based on personal relationships, professional relationships that drive a lot of these things.
Professor Fred McKinney is the guest talking to us from Quinnipiac University about the announced merger of United Technologies and Raytheon. Professor, on the surface, moving a corporate headquarters is not a lot of jobs. I think they said 100 jobs. You know, GE was just a corporate headquarters. But, you know, for the psyche, Professor, of a region, it's still not something you want to read or hear about.
That's correct. I mean, I think you're right. It's here you have a situation where, a Connecticut iconic corporation is going to technically move from Connecticut to Massachusetts. You know, the Fortune 500 came out not too long ago, and one of the things that they do in that document is they list the companies by state, Fortune 500 companies by state.
Yeah.
And they rank those companies by state. And UTC has always been up there with GE and a couple of others
mm-hmm.
that are the dominant corporations that call Connecticut home. That's not to say, as you know, that most of the business activity takes place in Connecticut, but this is their home. And so there's symbolism here, but I think some of that symbolism can be really important from a business point of view, and that, you know, there are decisions that have to be made all the time about where something should take place. And losing that headquarters is going to, I think, impact those future decisions about where companies make investments.
Professor, let's talk about one of the things that the new CEO said. He obviously he's asked about jobs, and he talks about keeping a significant presence in Connecticut. Is that kind of what he had to say, kind of dancing around the jobs issue? What do you think?
Well, there may be some truth to that, but I do think that politically it's the right thing to say if mm-hmm. you want to minimize the blowback from a move of this nature. You know, that's also a message that not only has external customers, but it has internal customers. I mean, these are people who work for a company that's been here for most of them all of their professional lives. And the prospect of picking up and moving to Connecticut for the top executives you know, will affect clearly those folks.
Mm-hmm.
But you have a lot of other folks who, you know, are not quite frankly as necessary from a corporate perspective to move to Boston. They may or may not move to Boston. I mean, it's, you think about some of the folks that are in the middle or on the lower level of the UTC employment tier.
Yeah.
You know, they may not move to Boston, or they may not be invited to move to Boston. So there will be some job losses or some displacement of people and affects their lives. So, you know, I think the CEO is probably saying the right things.
Sure.
Who knows? But I'm hopeful that he's accurate, that there will be minimal impact on Connecticut's workforce. You know, there is almost like a psychological effect.
Yeah, and
on the community when these things happen. It's like a blow to the stomach.
Yeah, and again, 19,000 UTC employees here in the state. So, you know, Professor, even if a significant workforce in Connecticut is 12 or 13,000 or 14,000, you know, to lose even 1,000 or 2,000 jobs or 3,000, I mean, just the ripple effect, as I talked about in the first hour of the show, that would be pretty significant from a psychological and from a business standpoint.
Right. Because it's not only when these corporations change, when they have these type, when they either go out of business or they have a major merger, you know, there are people who their people's lives are affected.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the things that this merger is, you know, proclaiming that it's going to save about $1 billion a year. Well, a lot of that money, they say, is going to come from synergies, as they like to say, in things like procurement.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you've got a chief procurement officer at Raytheon and a chief procurement officer at UTC, you don't need two of them.
One of them's going. Yeah.
One of them is going to go. And not only is that person going to go, but, you know, how this shakes out is going to affect a lot of other people.
Yeah.
And that's not true just with procurement. I mean, it happens across sort of the infrastructure of a corporation. So again, another example is marketing. You might have you have marketing people in both groups. Some of those guys and gals may be on the outs because of this merger.
Sure, and Professor, obviously, a publicly held companies, right? And you and I both know that, yeah, there's people's lives and homes involved here. But again, in this world, whether you and I like it or not, the chief fiduciary responsibility of a company is to its shareholders.
Money. That's correct. So, yeah, shareholders, you know, that's not how it worked out all the time, these activities. But, you know, somebody is doing the analysis, and you would think that analysis says that the combined group, the combined company, is going to be better off than the companies as separate entities.
Professor.
For the shareholders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Final question. If you had to look into your entrepreneur crystal ball, I don't know, a year, two, or three down the line here, would you think that UTC and the combined company now and Raytheon together, this new combined company, would you guess that they would look to further, reduce the workforce here in Connecticut while doing what the CEO said, still keeping a significant number here? You think more cuts are coming?
I think more changes are coming.
Okay.
I think that's the safest bet, that there will be more changes. And, you know, it's one thing to say, if you're corporate leaders in two different companies, to say, okay, we see these things on paper. It's another thing to actually execute. These mergers are not easy, and they don't always work out. In
mm-hmm.
fact, the data shows that about 60% of mergers don't work.
Really?
Yeah, it's
wow.
A high percentage of mergers that don't work. And a lot of the reason why they don't work has to do with non-business things that, you know, people in business call culture. So even though these two companies are large defense contractors, they have some commercial business as well. They are two separate companies that have two separate histories and two separate cultures. So the biggest challenge that I think that they're going to face, whether this thing is going to work or not, is going to be more dependent on these companies' ability to bring their cultures together.
It's like trying to make that big trade with the other team, and you make a 5-for-5 trade, and you're hoping the five guys you bring in fit in the clubhouse, right?
There you go, or it's like a marriage.
Yeah. Got it. Professor Fred McKinney is the Carlton Highsmith Chair of Entrepreneurship and Strategy, and he's director of the People's United Center for Entrepreneurship and Strategy at Quinnipiac University in Hammond. Professor, we thank you on short notice. We appreciate the time. Thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Well, there you go. It's a marriage, folks. There it is. So thanks to Professor Fred McKinney there at Quinnipiac University in Hammond. The bubonic plague, also referred to as the Black Death. Believe it or not, it's still around. It's not completely gone. There are fewer than 1,000 cases a year here in the U.S. and around the world, but it's still around. But there was a time at the turn of last century that it was a worry that it could wipe out a significant number of the U.S. population. And joining us right now on the program here on Connecticut Today to talk about his new book about that is author David K. Randall. He's the author of Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. David, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Why a book on the plague, David? Interesting topic. Why that?
Well, it's kind of a roundabout story. My last book was about the family that used to own all of Malibu, California. Mm-hmm. And in that story, one of the main characters goes up to San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century, and he writes a letter back to his wife saying, you know, this is the wickedest place I've ever seen, and there's rumors that the plague is here. And I was really struck by the word rumors, because mm-hmm. it seems like an outbreak of plague would be something that everybody knew about it or wouldn't. And as I started researching it, I found there really was a conspiracy between the city's mayor, the governor of California, and the state's most powerful newspapers to conceal the fact of the plague. And they put millions of people's lives at risk. And I started seeing that there are many parallels to today as well.
Parallels to today in what sense?
Well, there was a big strain of denialism at the time. The city of San Francisco and California at large didn't want to admit that the danger they were in. And they also didn't want to admit that this was a time when science and medicine were rapidly changing. Mm-hmm. You know, this was the era where somebody was considered a good doctor, not because they were, you know, really fast with a knife, because there wasn't pain medication available, to the idea that, you know, laboratory science and microscopes and people in white lab coats, that's what medicine and science really is now. Mm-hmm. This was the big change there. And this was a big fight over legitimacy of science. And you see those things now, too, and ways that, you know, people don't want to admit that there could be a danger from anything from climate change to different diseases now.
Yeah, and this, it's fascinating. You say that a lot of this story centers around a Chinese gentleman who developed, you know, some symptoms, was not doing well, died. But it was, what, one doctor who kind of noticed something was awry here?
Exactly. So there was a doctor in San Francisco. His name was Joseph Kenyon, and he was a public health officer. And he was considered the most brilliant scientist in the U.S. at the time. And he was in San Francisco not because of the plague, but essentially, he'd been exiled there. The Surgeon General in D.C., there's a power clash, essentially, and he sent him out to San Francisco. So Kenyon was there. He realized how dangerous plague could be, that it could spread rapidly in San Francisco and decimate the city like it had done in Hong Kong and India, where over 15 million people died. And he knew that one person infected with the plague could get on a railroad, a train going east, and suddenly you could have the plague spread from, you know, Chicago to Pittsburgh to New York to Connecticut, everywhere it's along the line. So he continued to sound the alarm and try to contain the disease, even as everybody in the city and the state worked against him.
You know, it's interesting here, and David, you touched on this just before we had to go to the break. The plague killed millions back then, didn't it?
It did. So everybody knows, you know, the plague in Europe. You hear about it in middle school or high school, how it, you know, decimated half the population in Europe in the 1300s. What most people don't know is that there was another worldwide outbreak of the plague, and it came from China. And this, it started in 1870, and then it spread throughout the world. This was the era of steamships. So this was the first time that, you know, people and goods could cross the Pacific that quickly. And it spread from Hong Kong to Honolulu, mm-hmm. and then it reached North America for the first time in San Francisco in 1900.
And again, San Francisco, as you portray it in the book, interesting. A lot of people don't realize that it kind of was a two-sided city, right? I mean, it was really the gateway to the western U.S. with all ships coming in, but it was a pretty corrupt place as well.
Exactly. It kind of built itself as the Paris of the had more art and culture than anywhere else on the West Coast. But at the same time, it was only a generation away from the gold rush. So there are still, you know, literally people who were 49ers walking the streets mm-hmm. of San Francisco. And it was a very corrupt place. You know, the mayor and the governor, too, were heavily involved in trying to always just boost up California and San Francisco as this, you know, Eden, trying to get more people to come to move out west. And they didn't want anything that could imperil the city or affect its economy.
So Joseph Kenyon, he's faced with this now. You mentioned that his lab was on Angel Island, kind of the West Coast version of Ellis Island here. What actions did he take? He was faced with quite a task here.
So he was trying to contain the disease as much as possible. He knew how dangerous it was, so he continued going, you know, more and more extreme. And he was one of those people who was, you know, brilliant in the laboratory but had no kind of social intelligence. So he had this talent for making people hate him. So eventually he tried to do forced inoculations of it wasn't quite a vaccine, but it was something that helped prevent, to a certain extent, someone getting plague. He tried to do forced inoculations in Chinatown, going door to door. And Chinese immigrants living there started hiding patients from him, hiding the bodies, essentially, because they feared what he was doing. So he essentially was trying to contain this disease with a blindfold. And eventually he was essentially run out of the state. A state senator said in Sacramento that he should be hanged for what he was doing to the state.
You mentioned, you know, forced inoculations. I mean, what you said, it wasn't exactly a vaccine, but you know, what kind of level of infectious disease knowledge existed back then to have him do this?
This was still really in the early days. This was a time where people really were, and Kenyon worked with some of the people who developed the first vaccines for things like smallpox and diphtheria and everything else. So what Kenyon was trying to administer was what was called a Haskine serum, which reduced someone's chances of getting plague by about 30 or 40%. Mm-hmm. But it had a very, you know, very strong side effects. People didn't want to take it. It made your entire body go flush for several days. You had high fever. You had delusions. You know, you had aches and pains. It seemed like one of those cases where people didn't want to believe that disease was there in place. So why should they subject themselves to this?
You also talk about, you're mentioning Joseph Kenyon, obviously, the role of Rupert Blue here. Talk about him a little.
So Rupert Blue was essentially Kenyon's successor. He was brought in, he was another public health officer who was brought in after Kenyon was essentially sent out. Where Kenyon really represented the hard side of science, you know, epidemiology and tracking a disease and working to discover a vaccine or a cure, Blue really represented the softer side of science. His abilities were not in the laboratory. He was never considered a genius. But what he did was he had a very strong sense of affability. He knew how to get people to like him mm-hmm. and trust him. And, you know, eventually having us trust in him to take the steps that he was recommending and to believe that, you know, not only should they do something to protect themselves, but they should protect others as well. And one thing I was really struck by was, you know, we have an outbreak of measles again.
Yeah.
After that disease was eradicated. It really does take both sides to contain a public health crisis. You know, Kenyon by himself he was a brilliant man, but he was ineffectual. Whereas Blue was not all of those, you know, academically lauded, but he was much more effectual, and he ended up becoming a national hero that nobody ever has heard of.
Whenever you look at, or whenever I read about scenarios like this, you know, century and a half ago, you know, or how many years ago, 110 years, 120 years, I'm astonished at the people, you know, like Kingan and Blue, who were able to get done what they were able to do with relatively, and maybe primitive is the wrong word, but relatively compared to today, primitive technology. And I'm sure a major city whose sanitary conditions probably in some areas, I would think, left a little to be desired.
Well, San Francisco was absolutely filthy at the time. And so were most major cities. This was really, not only was it a revolution in science, this was the time they discovered that germs cause disease. It was through the fight against plague in San Francisco that Blue demonstrated for the first time that sanitation measures and focusing on rats could save the city. But at the same time, this was the revolution in public sanitation and hygiene. Blue did many things that now are considered common sense, but were revolutionary at the time. He instituted things like street sweeping and rat-proofing trash cans and putting cement sidewalks instead of wooden sidewalks so it prevents rats from burrowing underneath. And all of these things together, they were called the Great Sanitary Awakening. And, you know, along with things like developing antibiotics and medicines, these helped extend the lifespan of the average American by about 30 years. So Blue really revolutionized how all of us live. And at the same time, you go back and you realize how close we came to a national disaster. Plague continued to spread in Hong Kong in the 1930s. And it was only because of Blue that millions of people's lives in the U.S. were spared.
So they were able to put up a barrier. The barrier was their work then in San Francisco that, would you say, kept a significant amount of the American population, or at least a large amount, from contracting a further spread of the plague?
Definitely. All it really took, you know, plague is a very fast-spreading disease.
Mm-hmm.
If it gets to the pneumatic form of plague, which means it gets into your lungs, it can be spread just by coughing. So if somebody had that and they got on a train heading east, within, you know, 3 or 4 days, you would have it spread across the country.
Well, it's kind of similar to what it's similar to what they say about measles now.
Exactly. And what's interesting was this Blue later, you know, he became the U.S. Surgeon General later, and he was one of the first ones who put in place health guidelines for jet travel. So it really was this era of the world is changing rapidly, but we still have this ancient, you know, medieval disease that we still have to fight. So this was the first clash between modern medicine and probably the most terrifying disease in human history.
David, there are a handful, right, of bubonic plague cases still pop up every year.
Exactly. Most people don't realize this is a disease just of the past. We still deal with it now. In the U.S., it's about 10 people a year.
Uh-huh.
It's mostly in rural places in the West, so, you know, Idaho, some places in New Mexico, it spreads in the prairie dog population. Even Yosemite in California, if you go there, there's signs warning you that squirrels can carry plague, so to stay away from what looks like diseased animals.
So it's one of these diseases. So it's one of these diseases that, despite our best efforts, kind of because it's not widely contracted by people, we kind of can't get rid of it completely. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. So it stays in rodent and rodent flea populations. So it'll spread from, you know, rats to squirrels to prairie dogs. If someone catches it, they have between about 48 and 72 hours before essentially they die of it. It can be treated and it can be cured with antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is it's just a very short window. So if you're somebody who doesn't have access to a doctor, or your doctor doesn't know to look for some of these warning signs, then it can be a fatal thing very quickly.
How difficult was it for you, David, to write this book? Is the documentation, a lot of the stuff you needed, is that readily available, or did you have to dig for it?
I had to dig. So one thing that was hard to do was most of the victims in San Francisco during the first outbreak, there were two outbreaks, were Chinese immigrants in Chinatown. And there was just not as many written documents. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a population where many people at the time didn't read or write. So they weren't, you know, writing down how they felt or what they did. So it was a little bit of a detective story trying to find each victim and find out as much about his or her life as possible to really show that these were real people and this was a real threat to the country. This wasn't just, oh, wow, you know, almost sounds like an episode of X-Files or something. This really happened, and we are incredibly lucky that it wasn't worse.
So worst case scenario, had these two gentlemen not been so driven as to what they wanted to do, the city of San Francisco, at least for maybe a generation or so, could have been left in virtual ruin.
Exactly, and that's what you saw in Hong Kong. In Hong Kong, you know, millions of people died. Hospitals were reporting a 95% death rate from the disease, and entire neighborhoods were essentially abandoned to the rats. And that continued well into the 1930s. So it was almost provides the perfect counter example that if it weren't for, you know, these two doctors and the work they did at great personal cost, that could have easily happened in the U.S.
You mentioned before, finally, that not only San Francisco, but a lot of major cities back then, even, you know, because you were right on the cusp of the Industrial Revolution, but the horses were still the main mode of transportation. I mean, some of these cities that may look glamorous in some of these early photos, but I mean, man, you're right. They were just, it was filthy, even in some of the most quote unquote modern cities.
Exactly. So, you know, Blue, after he essentially saved San Francisco, then went to places like New Orleans and Philadelphia and New York and instituted many of these sanitary measures that we take for granted. But, you know, back 100 years ago, in the meatpacking district in New York, literally blood would spill out into the streets and boys would stand on the corner with brooms and you pay them a nickel and they'd sweep away a path through the muck for you to get through. These were abhorrent conditions. And Blue made us realize that life, the conception of life, can be different. That if your life is suddenly 30 years longer, you start paying attention to things in a different way, and things have different meanings.
Interesting thought, yeah. David K. Randall, thank you. The name of the book, Black Death at the Golden Gate. David, good luck, and hopefully we'll speak to you in the future. Thanks so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Appreciate it, and good luck with the book. All right, there you go, folks.